The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading articles to you published by the Religion News Service. The first of these was published on December 27 and written by Catherine Post. William Barber II, escorted out of movie theater, denied disability accommodations. The Reverend William Barber is no stranger to being escorted by police away from scenes of protest. The Disciples of Christ pastor and civil rights organizer has been arrested multiple times at nonviolent demonstrations on behalf of voting rights, a federal minimum wage, and other social justice issues. But even Barber was surprised to find himself being escorted by police out of a showing of The Color Purple at Greenville, North Carolina's AMC Fire Tower 12 movie theater on Tuesday, December 26, after employees barred the minister from using his own chair to watch the movie with his 90-year-old mother. It's one of those things where I don't know how much longer I'll have to do things like that with her, said Barber, who co-chairs the Poor People's Campaign and recently founded the Center for Public Theology and Public Policy at Yale Divinity School. Barber, 60, has been public about his battle with a painful chronic form of arthritis known as ankylosing spondylitis. He walks haltingly using two canes and told RNS that he is unable to sit in a wheelchair or in low chairs. He travels with his own chair and almost always uses it instead of the seating provided in public places. My chair has been everywhere, Barber told RNS, in hospitals and restaurants and airports, in the White House and in Congress. It's a need that I have because I face a very debilitating arthritic condition. Barber brought his chair, as usual, to the AMC Theater, he said, taking care to place it in the handicap cutout so it wouldn't obstruct any pathways or sight lines. According to Barber, management claimed the chair was a fire code violation and said the theater only accommodates wheelchairs. Barber insisted that the Americans with Disabilities Act requires the theater to make accommodations, he said, and told the employees he had never encountered an issue with the chair elsewhere. When he asked to see the theater's accommodation rules, which weren't posted, Barber said, management allegedly told him they didn't have the rules in writing. As the previews played on the screen, two police officers approached Barber and said the theater wanted him removed. I'm going to take you out, one police officer told Barber in a video Barber provided to RNS. I cannot go out in good conscience, Barber responded in the video. The recording shows the police officers walking behind and alongside Barber as he slowly exited the theater, a cane in each hand. Ryan Noonan, a spokesperson for AMC Theaters, told RNS on Wednesday, "We sincerely apologize to Bishop Barber for how he was treated and for the frustration and inconvenience brought to him, his family, and his guests." Noonan said that AMC's chairman and CEO, Adam Aaron, had contacted Barber and plans to meet with him next week. Noonan also made clear that AMC welcomes people with disabilities. Our theater teams work hard to accommodate guests who have needs that fall outside of the normal course of business, he added. This is not the ancient world where people who are sick are pushed to the side and told, you can't participate, Barber told RNS. With our laws, you have to make accommodation. The Americans with Disabilities Act requires businesses to provide people with disabilities an equal opportunity to access their services or goods. Barber declined to discuss whether he would be pursuing legal action, but he insisted that the important takeaway wasn't that this happened to him, but that it could happen to anyone with disabilities. I always look at things through the lens of, if it happened to me, it's not really about me, he said. I really am worried about how many other people feel they can't go out. They can't go somewhere. The next piece is an opinion piece written by Rabbi A. James Rudin, who is the American Jewish Committee's senior interreligious advisor and author of numerous books. Top Stories of the Year in Judaism. As 2023 began, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had recently returned to power with a right-wing governing coalition that included radical Jewish nationalists, raising questions of Jewish identity, and inflaming relations with Muslims over the use of the holy sites around the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex and the Western Wall. When Hamas attacked Israel on October 7 from Gaza at the end of the Jewish high holidays, it named its assault Al-Aqsa Deluge, painting the violence as a religious war. But Hamas action has become a major turning point in the 75-year-old Israeli-Palestinian conflict, embroiling emotions around the world and subjecting Jews far from the fighting to anti-Semitic insults and violence. Though the war dominated news about Judaism and Jews for the latter part of 2023, there were also signs of revival amid the turmoil. A year in review. 1. The Israel-Hamas War. On October 7, Hamas carried out its ferocious slaughter of 1,200 Israeli civilians and military personnel, seizing more than 240 hostages and taking them back to Gaza. It was the deadliest assault on the Jewish people since the end of the Holocaust in 1945. The terrorist attack, savage in its bloody murder of whole families and its sexual violence, shattered Israel's sense of national security months after Israelis celebrated their hard-won independence 75 years ago. Many Israelis and people across the Jewish diaspora felt equally violated by a political and popular response that often justified the attack as the result of Israeli policy. Critics labeled the Jewish nation a nation of privileged white colonizers, ignoring that the wide diversity of the Israeli Jewish population of 7.2 million people stems from Iran, Iraq, Ethiopia, Morocco, Egypt, Yemen, and other African and Asian countries, many of whom fled to Israel to escape religious and political persecution. At the United Nations, meanwhile, the organization that in 1947 called for the partition of British Mandate Palestine into a Jewish state and an Arab state, consistently singled out Israel for condemnation, continuing a streak of adopting more resolutions aimed at criticizing Israel than all the other countries combined. By mid-November, American Jews and their allies rallied on the National Mall in Washington to counteract the attention given to protest to Israel's response to Hamas. As many as 290,000 people participated in the March for Israel. An extraordinary cross-section of the American Jewish community was joined by evangelical Christian speakers and a remarkably bipartisan contingent from Congress, as the crowd chanted its opposition to an early ceasefire. 2. The battle against anti-Semitism. Even before October 7, the number of virulent, often lethal, anti-Semitic acts exploded in many parts of the world, including the U.S. In May, the Biden White House announced a strategy to counteract anti-Semitism, including education initiatives and funding to bolster security at Jewish institutions nationwide. In the aftermath of the Hamas attack on Israel, college and university campuses became the scene of vicious verbal and physical attacks upon Jewish students and faculty members. President Joe Biden, who has pledged U.S. support for Israel's military response to the Hamas massacre, doubled down on his attempt to mitigate anti-Semitism, calling the surge in anti-Jewish sentiment sickening at a White House Hanukkah ceremony. That same week, however, a congressional hearing exposed the weak responses to anti-Semitic incidents on campus. Asked about loudly proclaimed threats of genocide against Jews at one college, the presidents of Harvard University, the University of Pennsylvania, and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology seemed to waffle. Penn's president was forced to resign a few days after her tepid public testimony. 3. Protests against Israel's judicial overhaul. Between January and September, hundreds of thousands of people of all ages and backgrounds marched every Saturday night in Israel to oppose Netanyahu's proposed changes to the judicial system, which would significantly weaken the power of the Jewish state Supreme Court. The war against Hamas suspended both the weekly marches and other efforts, but it is an issue sure to return to a bitterly divided Israeli population. 4. A new demand for rabbis in new roles. While enrollment in many rabbinic schools in the U.S. is down, the demand for rabbis is increasing. In 2023, non-Orthodox Jewish seminaries continued to adapt to a shifting environment that departed from the traditional role of rabbi as the spiritual leader of a congregation. Non-Orthodox rabbinic training often includes curriculum change, tuition reduction, and online learning. Rabbis are needed as hospital chaplains, educators, campus clergy, and organizational professionals. The year saw para-rabbinic training in an effort to attract seminary students. 5. A boom in Torah reading at Sepharia. The online library of Jewish texts, Sepharia, the name is derived from the Hebrew word for book, has become the go-to destination for people who want to study Judaism's basic religious texts in their original languages of Hebrew and Aramaic, accompanied by superb English translation. It has also led to an unanticipated boom in reading these scriptures. In 2023, more than 600,000 visitors clicked onto Sepharia each month to study the Bible, Mishnah, Talmud, Midrash, Halakha, liturgy, religious thought, and many other texts, as well as accessing online dictionaries and encyclopedias. 6. Remembering the legacy of Golda Meir. 45 years after her death, the remarkable legacy of former Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir was celebrated in a motion picture starring Helen Mirren as the tough-minded leader who led her nation through the 1973 Yom Kippur War. The film complements a new biography of Mirren, published in August by Deborah Lipstadt, the U.S. Special Envoy to Monitor and Combat Anti-Semitism. In 2023, we also mark the deaths of these remarkable Jewish leaders and thinkers. Shlomo Avineri, a prominent Israeli academic and foreign ministry official. David Ellenson, a renowned rabbinic scholar and president of the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion. Daniel Ellsberg, a military analyst who caused a national political controversy in 1971 by publicly releasing the Pentagon Papers, a top-secret U.S. government decision-making document related to the Vietnam War. Dianne Feinstein, a long-serving U.S. senator from California. Judith Heumann, who championed the cause of disabled people. Henry Kissinger, a former Secretary of State. Harold Kushner, a rabbi and author of the best-selling book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And lastly, Norman Lear, creator of the popular TV show All in the Family and many other iconic television comedies. Now an article written by Jana Rice and published on December 22nd, entitled, I Volunteered with Light the World Giving Machines for Christmas. Here's what I saw. In Latter-day Saint circles, it seems to be a trope that whenever we perform an act of service, we talk about how grateful we are for the opportunity to serve and how it helped us more than it did the recipient. Well, last night I volunteered to help with Cincinnati's Light the World giving machines. Not to sound like a cliche, but I'm grateful for the opportunity, which I found touching and surprising. I doubt it helped me more than the recipients of the charity, but it certainly put me in a much better mood than I'd been in since I've been grieving the sudden death of an old friend. As background, the giving machines launched in 2017 when the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints had a single one in Salt Lake City. People responded to the unique vending machine concept. Just swipe a credit card and give a cow or some textbooks to a child in need. That first year, the church raised more than $500,000 for global and local charities from that single machine. Every year since then, or at least every year when we haven't been in a global pandemic, the program has grown. In 2022, there were machines in 28 cities, and the effort raised more than $6 million for charity. This year, the church is more than double the number of cities that got machines, which explains why our humble city of Cincinnati received some, with more than 61 locations around the world. Also new this year is the fact that more than 250 nonprofits are participating in the effort as recipients of people's gifts, which the church says is more charities than all of the previous years of the program added together. In my area, we got three machines set up in the Macy's corridor of the Kenwood Mall. Kenwood is that spotted owl of 21st century retail, a busy, successful indoor legacy mall. So we had a great deal of foot traffic, especially because one of the suburban wards decided to have its youth night right there inside the mall, where they brought their whole families and people made donations. There were a couple of live musicians playing and lots of wonderful low-key socializing. We didn't have very many takers who didn't seem to already be members of the church, but church members were certainly excited about it. Some of my fellow volunteers drove down from Dayton, about an hour away, and I've heard of families traveling from as far away as Cleveland just to make a donation and teach their kids more about charitable giving. I spoke with Mark Motley, a volunteer coordinator for our area, who said, it's a blessing to these kids to get to choose for themselves what they want to give. They pick out the soap or the goat or whatever they want to do, and then it becomes real for them, and you see that sort of light sparkle. I saw it too, the sparkle in the kids' eyes. They seem fully engaged in the process. Incidentally, the aforementioned goat was probably our strongest seller, with backpacks a close second. I know there is a legitimate criticism to be made of the consumerist mentality that physically equates charitable giving to, say, buying a bottle of Coca-Cola, but I can't deny that people loved it, and I was touched by their excitement. I'm happy to see the church doing this, giving from its vast resources to help small and large nonprofits work for good in the world. Some of the organizations we could support in the giving machines last night included international ones such as the Red Cross and Lifting Hands International. But others were local to Cincinnati, including our Catholic charity and Shelter House, which aims to break the cycle of homelessness in our city. I understand that other cities' giving machines have a similar mix of international and local options. As I've chronicled painfully in this column, the news that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints was hoarding more than $100 billion in its stock portfolio just about broke me. Since then, I have learned more about the church's finances and have come to realize that $100 billion is only a portion of its wealth. The total figure is likely significantly higher. I do not believe any church that claims to represent Jesus Christ in the world should be hoarding that much wealth. It is obscene, outrageous, and spiritually dangerous. Having been burned before, I've become cautious about reports that the church has recently upped its game in charitable giving. Compared with the wealth it's sitting on, even donations of a few million dollars here and there are frankly a drop in the bucket. I've also seen skepticism online about whether the charities actually benefit from the money that's promised to them through these giving machines. I understand why people wonder about this, since the church has broken trust about how it handles its finances. Happily, I have heard from charities themselves that they do receive every penny donated to them through the giving machines. In addition, the church handles the credit card transaction fees, which could have dipped into their donations by 3%. I did notice that prominently displayed on the side of every giving machine at the Cincinnati location is the promise that 100% of donors' contributions would be given to the charities of their choice. I'm not sure if the giving machines from earlier years needed to carry that disclaimer, or if that is a response to the deep mistrust the church has sown about its finances. In any case, it's good to see that church is publicly making that promise and standing by it. It was an honor to be part of the effort. Our last piece is an opinion written by Baptist minister and president and CEO of Interfaith Alliance, Dr. Paul Brandeis Rushenbush. Don't let the war tear apart the tapestry of faith that makes America strong. In one weekend this month, hundreds of synagogues and Jewish communal organizations were targeted by bomb threats, causing evacuations and concern for the safety of thousands of Jewish Americans. These attempts to terrorize American Jews add to the exponential rise of anti-Semitism and anti-Jewish violence that seemed unimaginable a decade ago, and add to the fear and existential threat felt by my Jewish friends, colleagues, and family. Jews, unfortunately, are not alone. Threats and violence have also been aimed at Muslims, whose communities have experienced a horrific spike in hate crime, some of which have led to injury and, most poignantly, the death of a young boy. Mosques are on high alert, and Muslims I know have shared the pain of feeling targeted and isolated. They fear for their safety and future. In addition to daily anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, both of these communities are shouldering the heavy burden of a war in the Middle East. That war has come with a degree of loss unknown to today's Israelis and Palestinians, losses that are deeply felt among their connections and communities here in the U.S. I recently spoke with Imam Abdullah Antepli, a leader who has worked for peace between Jews and Muslims for decades. Three of his former students, Jewish Israelis, were killed by Hamas on October 7. 5 days later, he lost five Muslim colleagues in Gaza. We at Interfaith Alliance, the organization I lead, have heard from members of our affiliate network about the pain they are carrying, including a rabbi who is caring for his congregation while also grieving a loved one killed in the October 7 attack. Those of us who work to bring better understanding among people of diverse faith traditions, no matter our own faith, are horrified to see the religious tapestry that makes up American democracy begin to fray and tear apart. Having worked for interfaith cooperation for almost 3 decades, I've never experienced a more challenging and heartbreaking time. Yet, inaction and retreat are not the answer. I've never been more convinced that we can and we must continue to be in relationship with one another. We can feel passionately that our own views on the crisis are just, even as we acknowledge that others may have different views. We must acknowledge the pain people are feeling on all sides and acknowledge the humanity of people we disagree with. We must not succumb to the temptation to dismiss the other, mustn't harden our hearts, as the Jewish scholar J. Michelson, quoting the Bible's book of Hebrews, said on the Interfaith Alliance podcast in October. Our disagreements cannot and must not stop us from working together to counteract the rising hate targeting the Muslim and Jewish communities. I am inspired by the people from a wide range of traditions who have come together, seeking understanding and pledging one another support. Recently, Interfaith Alliance members attended the national launch of a multi-faith commitment to fight anti-Muslim and anti-Jewish bigotry, led by the Shoulder to Shoulder campaign, a group founded to push back against Islamophobia in America. The leaders of this organization recognized that while the Israel-Hamas war had contributed to the hate Jews and Muslims were experiencing, Islamophobia and anti-Semitism were at their highest level in decades before the war, in large part due to the rise in Christian nationalism that is plaguing our country and that will take all of us to defeat. This is not the time to retreat into ourselves. We need each other. We must get back to the basics of dialogue and relationship. To spark this movement, Interfaith Alliance recently produced an Interfaith Community Pledge, in which we commit to the belief that the forces that unite us are greater than those that divide us, that we will create space for the needs of impacted communities, that we reject hate in all forms, and that we remain committed to dialogue and the endurance of our interfaith partnerships. I urge you to join us. In this holy season, in my own Christian tradition, my fervent prayers for peace in the Middle East and an end to the killing. My prayer is equally for peace in our communities in the U.S., so that we might come together to work for the end of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, and for the freedom, rights, and dignity of each person, and continue the work of achieving our democracy. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payton, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.